Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com. Today's program was brought to you by the 2016 Food and Enterprise Summit, presented by Slow Money NYC. Tickets available at foodandenterprise.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, where we serve a weekly menu of industry commentary based on what the market has to offer. I'm Andrew Friedman from Tokeland.com.
I'm Jimmy Bradley from The Red Cat.
If you follow the chef world, as we imagine most of our listeners do, you probably know that Food & Wine magazine announced its Best New Chefs inductees for 2016 this week. It was a list that included chefs from New York and Los Angeles, Seattle and San Francisco, Austin and New Orleans, Miami and Chicago. But what you may not know about Best New Chefs is that the program actually dates back to 1988. With 10 inductees every year, sometimes 11 if a restaurant has two chefs, as one of our guest restaurants does today. The first class included such future legends as Thomas Keller, Daniel Boulud, and Rick Bayless. And the Food & Wine Best New Chefs program continued to predict a lot of top talent in the ensuing years and continues to do so today. And the roots of the award actually go even further back to a very famous, at the time, Food & Wine honor roll that the magazine published in 1983, which recognized a number of players in the then-fledgling community of American chefs, such as Jonathan Waxman, Mary Sue Milliken, Susan Feniger, Barry Wine, and the late Leslie Revson and Judy Rogers, who actually, for its time, was an impressively co-ed group of chefs and influencers. In the studio today, to talk about Best New Chefs then and now, we have Food & Wine's relatively new editor-in-chief, Nilu Motamed. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And two of this year's Best New Chefs from Contra and Wild Air restaurants here in New York City, Jeremiah Stone and Fabian von Hosk. Thank you for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
And big congratulations.
Thank you.
We also have by phone Katie Button. Are you there, Katie?
I am.
Welcome. Katie's from Curate Restaurant in Asheville, where I've eaten. It's fantastic. Asheville, North Carolina. And a young Best New Chef veteran who was inducted last year. Also want to mention, if I'm correct on this, Katie, your book, Curate, Authentic Spanish Food from an American Kitchen, is due out this October. And in a little while, we're going to be joined on the phone by Tom Valenti, most recently of West Restaurant in New York City, who was a really early inductee into this program back in its third year in 1990, alongside such people as Mark Peel and Nancy Silverton. So, Nilu, why don't we just start with you? You know, it's a huge chef world out there in this country. You know, I was just mentioning the early years. There's exponentially more talent out there. And more notable talent probably in a lot more places. Can you just talk a little bit about how the magazine goes about doing this? How do names come in? How are they vetted? And then how in the world do you guys whittle it down?
It's not easy. As you say, there's an amazing amount of talent in the U.S. The chef world is more dynamic than ever. And you said I was relatively new. I'm under a month right now.
Okay. I was trying to be polite.
No, I think it's exciting. So the magazine has taken the chef culture incredibly seriously and has been a pioneer in showcasing chefs. And we will continue to do that. And for this program, which I think is one of the programs that is as important both to our readers as it is to the industry. I think that I really appreciate the fact that chefs look at this as a real milestone in their careers. And so we take it incredibly seriously. And it's a year-long process in which we start out by putting out feelers, just like you do with any kind of curation in a magazine, and reach out to local critics, reach out to the people who we trust in our network. And once we get that original list, then there is a process of going incognito to the restaurants and trying them ourselves. And so this is, it takes a long time. Our restaurant editor, Kate Crater, leads the march on this, but many of the editors are involved throughout the year. And what I loved this year, since I'm new, was hearing from the chefs that, in fact, they had no idea when Food & Wine visited, and it truly is something that we do completely incognito. And then, and after that, about just under, just over a month before they come to New York for their Best New Chef Award, which was just a couple of days ago, we reach out to them and we tell them the news. We don't tell them who else is on the list, and then we ask them for their recipes. So it's a kind of a fast forward, getting all their recipes, testing their recipes, getting them ready for our July issue where we feature them in the magazine.
When you say you reach out to them, is there a specific way you do it? And also in your selection process, do past recipients of the award inform you or recommend candidates to you?
Of course. The thing is that what we say when the new class of Best New Chefs joins us is that they're part of our family. And Jimmy, you know this. It's one of those things where all the former Best New Chefs really are part of the Food & Wine family and part of our culture. And so, of course, they are definitely people who we reach out to, and we trust their insights because they know who we are and what Food & Wine stands for. In terms of the way that the chefs find out, it's either by phone call. We have done it on FaceTime before, which is entertaining, and we did do it once by video, just to freak people out. We have two brand new Best New Chefs here who can attest to how it feels to get that call, but I think it's a pretty exciting time, and I think the hardest thing must be keeping it to yourself for over a month. That's really, really hard, but I'm super, super impressed that none of the chefs seem to break, and they do really make up all sorts of excuses for why they're going to be coming to New York, especially since a lot of them do know each other and have worked together before and have done pop-ups together before or have worked together in other kitchens. They take it as seriously as we do.
Yeah, it's funny. I got to compliment these guys because I was at Wild Air for dinner maybe 2 weeks ago, and we'd already been talking to the magazine about doing this show with you, with the magazine. We didn't know who was going to be winning, and I said hello to Fabian, and he says, how's the podcast going? And I said, okay. And he said, we'd come on sometime if you want. And I'm like, oh, that'd be... So the other night I saw him at your guy at the Food & Wine Best New Chefs party. I said, did you know you were coming in when you said that to me? And he said, yeah, I knew. But it was a good poker face.
Yeah, I don't want to play poker against you guys.
Fabian, why don't you tell, or whose phone rang? Or did the restaurant phone ring? How did it happen? How did you guys get the news?
Yeah, so a day before we got the call, we did this Cookie for Cancer event, and Kate Crater was there. And I've known Kate for like 7 years. She's always been on me, even before the restaurant, which I really appreciate. And we had like a very personal conversation with her, and it kind of felt weird. And yeah, she sent me a text the day after, like super early, and she's like, are you with Jeremiah? I need to call you. I was like, okay. And she called me, and that was it. That was a call.
Wow, I have goosebumps now.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Go ahead, Jeremiah. I think when we saw her at this charity event, she seemed like she had a dead body she had to dispose of. Uh-huh. She was like really nervous, and she wanted to tell us something, but she couldn't. And we were like, what's going on with her? And then she called us the next day. She was like, I really wanted to tell yesterday.
And what's it like? I mean, this is the kind of thing like, people talk about getting like the Michelin call, right? And it's just instant pandemonium in the restaurant because it's basically the day of the event or the day before, when the list is about to come out. So it kind of gets out pretty fast. You had to keep this quiet, right? Like, how do you pull that off and not...
Did
you guys,
up and
like,
down.
Leave the restaurant to have a celebration? Or, like, what do you do?
We were just outside the door and...
on the street.
Yeah, on the Orchard Street.
I grabbed Jeremiah by the arm and just took him out on the street.
Like, I was in the middle of talking to someone, I think, and he just, like, ripped my shirt and was just like, come on! He was like, Food & Wine! And I was like, okay. And so he went outside, and then he was like, he put her put Kate on speakerphone, and then she was just like, she told us there's no one else outside, and she told us, and we were freaking out like while standing still and not trying to let. And then we walked back in the restaurant, took a moment just to take it all in, gave each other a big hug, and then went back to work, not saying anything to anyone. But every time we saw each other, like, big smile on our face, and we were like, you know, knowing something that we had to keep a secret.
Right. Yeah.
It's amazing in the industry, you know, when you get your review as well, like you have this moment, but then you walk in and you go back to business as usual.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Like there's the amount of time you allow yourself to celebrate sometimes is.
Yeah, I mean, we knew, like, you know, we had to get back to work, and there would be a time and a moment for us to share it and to celebrate. And I think that was, you know, it was really fun, just like everything culminating this past weekend and sharing it with family and friends and being able to tell everyone, and, you know, some people being like, oh, you didn't tell me. I'm like, yeah, we didn't tell anybody. You know,
yeah. Katie, I'd love to know, you're, you know, 1 year from your being inducted into this. What, you know, beyond obviously the honor of doing it, what is the program sort of meant in your professional life? In other words, you know, the kind of three or four days that you were in New York around the induction last year, did you meet chefs you didn't really know well? Have relationships formed out of that? Just sort of what's being a member of this sort of club meant in terms of your professional life?
It's been, you know, an amazing experience. First of all, it's something that, you know, the magazine issue of the Best New Chefs is one that I would flip through every year, like pining for. You know, thinking, oh gosh, how amazing would that be? And then, you know, when I got the phone call, it's an amazing moment. I had just had a baby 2 weeks prior, and I was sitting there at home and got a phone call from the editor. It was Dana Cowan at the time, and I couldn't even believe it. But since then, you know, just the relationship, all of a sudden, first of all, my Twitter exploded with messages from tons of former Best New Chefs, people that I greatly admire. You know, David Chang sent a tweet out. I'll never forget that. To me, I've never even met him, but it felt like you were joining a family and also getting recognized by your peers and being a part of that club. It's pretty special.
And what about, like the whole experience in New York? I mean, I assume it's a little bit different every year, but I know, you know, everyone's brought out a day or two, the ones who don't live here, a day or two before the party. I know there's usually a dinner of some kind. What can you just describe what that whole sort of, you know, sort of coming out week is like when you're in the middle of this program?
Absolutely. Well, it was a whirlwind. I mean, our days were packed with events and, you know, meet and greets and a photo shoot, and then the big party where you're meeting where you're finally being announced as one of the Best New Chefs. And I barely remember the actual, like, I remembered the whole time, but it was such a whirlwind of emotions and excitement and nervousness all at the same time that it kind of like blew by me. But it's certainly a moment that I'll never forget.
That's great. And what about are you in touch with people who were in your class or people you met through this
Absolutely. I keep running into the people in my class and other Best New Chef recipients at events, festivals all over the country. And it's pretty amazing because you feel like you have this immediate connection. I've become friends with you know, a bunch of people that I didn't know before, Greg and Gabrielle Denton from Ox in Portland. I keep running into them over and over, and we kind of have this special thing that we share, knowing that we were both in the Best New Chef recipients.
Great. We're going to take a minute here. Tom, are you there? Tom?
Yes.
Hey, how are you?
I can barely hear you.
Oh. Can you hear us now?
Say again?
Can you hear us now?
No. Not very well.
Okay, we're going to take a second to get things sorted out with the tech side over here. Guys, why don't you just tell us this? Well, first of all, I actually would love to just ask, you know, I've interviewed you guys. You seem to be, you have a pretty good familiarity with sort of you know, culinary history and whatnot. What was your awareness of sort of the heritage of this program and what it meant. It seems to me like, I don't know, the Best New Chef program seems to me to really kind of stand out in the in the chef world. I mean, people seem to at least know that it's been around a long time. But what was sort of its place in your mind?
I mean, for me personally, I think the first time I saw it was maybe like 2004, and I was cooking like not in a fine dining restaurant, not in a place that was like chef driven, and I saw that, you know, it's a kind of cover that grabs your eye when you're like at a bookstore or supermarket and you see magazines, and there's just a bunch of people in chef coats, and if you're in some, you know, you're in the industry in some way, you're like, what is this? Like it's some sort of honor. So I think I picked it up in, probably over 12 years ago. And I was like, wow, like this is like another level. Like I was like, I didn't know why, but I was like, I want to be on there one day.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was just seeing everyone kind of the way that they held themselves, and you open it up and it's like, you know, these guys are here because of this. And then I think, you know, as I started to get more into restaurants and seeing like, just some of the names that like I didn't know who these people were at the time, and it was like being exposed to them and then immediately thinking like, you know, where is this restaurant, what is this chef about, and kind of learning about, you know, new cuisines. And I think especially like if you're in one place, you kind of get stuck, you know, even in New York with all these people coming in, and you get stuck in knowing all the people to know in New York, and then you kind of forget about like places like Kansas City and like Seattle, and then you're like, oh, like someone's doing something really cool out there. And I think you know, that exposed me to a lot of different areas, and how like there was a huge community of chefs, and there, and like everyone was doing something different, everyone was trying to, you know, push the craft. And it's one of those things, like every year, you know, you see it and you're like, I want it, like I have to know who is on there, and like it's just incredible. Like it's always shot differently, like different, but it always looks the same. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you always see these bodies. You see 10 bodies on the cover. It says Food and Wine,
or 11.
Yeah, or 11, and so you know what it is. And I think that's, yeah, it was crazy for us to just think about that, because I think, you know, you set goals for yourself, and you know, you do the best you can, but like you never expect anything. You know?
Sure. Tom.
I wanted to add one thing to that.
Katie.
The best thing that has happened in this past year since being nominated is all of a sudden I felt like I have Food and Wine magazine in my corner. I mean, that's been amazing. They're calling me up, asking me for opportunities, events, you know, publicity. It's really neat, and it's a dedication that, you know, they're making, a commitment they're making to the chefs that they're nominating, not just, you know, this one-time award happening and then kind of being forgotten about.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Tom, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Oh, there
we go. How
are
you, Andrew?
Welcome to the show, Tom Valenti.
Thank you. And congratulations to this year's recipients. Should be very proud.
Thank you.
Tom, I'd love to just get a sense from you, because I think it's hard for people to understand this. You were inducted into the Food and Wine Best New Chefs in 1990. It was the third year of the program. You know, we mentioned at the top of the show, it predates even, and your induction actually predated by a year, even the James Beard Awards.
Right.
Can you just talk about your memories of when this program first kind of surfaced on the chef horizon, and what it meant in the early days, you know, before there was this sort of sea of similar programs, and before there was a food network, what it meant to have this thing that sort of connected these dots around the country for people, and what it meant to then find out that you were, you know, part of the third class.
Right. Well, you know, Andrew, obviously we all know that the Culinary Globe was much, much larger then. You know, we had the big three, Food and Wine at the top. You know, and leading up to my award in 1990, the previous 3 years, you know, for me, because of the lack of access, made me think of making, you know, culinary pilgrimages to such exotic lands as, you know, Berkeley or L.A. or Chicago. And it, you know, it, I think that the wide-eyed wonderment, wanted, you know, I wanted to know what these people were doing, how different regions around America were performing. Were they American bred? Were they French trained? But it, you know, it has no less impact now than it did then. There's just a lot more things going on that can be maybe, you know, maybe distracting sometimes.
Yeah, but when you say the pilgrimage, you mean you, I mean, you meant that was, I mean, these days so many people are sort of coming and going with such frequency. You meant really to just kind of even see what someone was about in a time before there was as much readily available information, I guess, as there is now, and maybe fewer forums for you all to kind of be in the same place.
Yeah, if, you know, very much so. I mean, if I want to watch Alice Waters cook like I did then, I could just go on YouTube now.
Right, right, right.
I have a thought.
Yeah.
You know, hey, Tom, Jimmy, how you doing?
Jimmy, how are you?
Great, thank you. Been a long time. Miss you, man.
Yeah, you too. Right back at you.
I guess, you know, receiving the award in the 1990s some time ago, and then, you know, being part of the landscape through the years and the changing of the landscape, I'm a little curious about, did you have a sense of what might be, what is going on now? Did you have a sense of what it might lead to? You know, were you feeling then about some of the progress that's come out today and chefs would be, you know, more spoken about and there's opportunities for chefs to speak to each other more and get to know each other more and things like that?
Well, you know, I think that back then we had a group that was local to New York and we kind of all knew each other. Many of us were, for I guess New York or the East Coast, we were the first wave of French-trained American chefs coming up in the ranks. And I think, you know, it really was kind of limited to what we were doing, and you know, it was all kind of encased on the island of Manhattan for the most part. I didn't really see anything coming until, you know, the advent of food on TV, and I'm not talking about Graham Kerr or Julia Child, but more of this this phenomenon that took us from, you know, blue collar workers to media stars. And obviously that brought on a much greater interest in youngsters who had access to seeing Mario or Bobby or Emeril. And I think that that's really when it really kind of exploded. There's TVs in like virtually every living room in America.
Yeah, it's funny, Tom. You talk about how the explosion, you know, I'm sitting here with a full list of the last, you know, the awards going all the way back to 1988. And if you go backwards from 90, just in the first 3 years, 90 being your class, Todd English and Nancy Silverton were that year. David Boulay and Nobu the year prior. And then in the first year, Rick Bayless, Daniel Ballou, Thomas Keller. At the time, each of those people had one restaurant.
That's right.
I mean, it's really a completely different universe that you all are kind of working in today to what it was back then.
For sure. For sure. Well, I think, well, you know, obviously the demand of more and more restaurants across the country, the investment interest in being involved in something as hearty, har-har, glamorous, you know, perpetuates more and more. Consequently, you know, the culinary educational institutions have a higher degree of interest, and consequently more and more people are applying and graduating. And that, you know, that's when you start seeing, you know, multiples of restaurants. It's an issue of demand.
Great. I'm sorry, Nilo wants to get in.
Well, I think the idea of these chefs, these very young chefs like the ones we have here, as entrepreneurs is something that we are really seeing on the list. These mini empires that chefs who haven't even been on the list have already put together. I think two of our chefs have done TED Talks. Three of our chefs started their restaurants in their own homes. So the idea of being so engaged in the idea of communicating their culinary vision. And I think I would say a lot of that comes from having seen Food & Wine magazine and having seen Best New Chefs along the way and seeing that this is an opportunity where you can actually go beyond just having one restaurant to having to being an empire builder.
That's a good one. Did you have something you wanted to say, Jeremiah?
No, I think, it's kind of crazy that, like, I always talk to, you know, I've been around a lot of the older chefs, like Andre Sultner and talking to Lance Sayak and all these guys that I kind of, you know, consider mentors. And they, you know, like Andre Sultner had, what, one restaurant for
37 years.
It's like 5 minutes and of like, work in 30 years.
And, you know, everyone offered him, you know, Tokyo and like, why don't you open Vegas? And, you know, I think that I kind of had that, you know, mentality. And then you see that, like, especially in New York, I think people like Dave Chang, like kind of helped pave the way and kind of help younger chefs understand like that, you know, there's a lot of things that need to go into opening a restaurant and being, you know, running a business in this economic climate and being in New York and like, and not, you know, not kind of squandering the opportunities because, you know, we talk about all these things happening, you know, the awards and the attention, and it's kind of like, what do you do with that? Like, do you invest that the right way? You know, you're given all these pieces and like, do you put the puzzle together or, you know, do you just sit there and say, well, thank you, and, you know, put it in your back pocket? I think, like, you know, there's a way to go wrong about that, but I think it's kind of learning how to keep the level of quality up, and then how to say, well, you know, we have all these eyes on us, this attention and people helping us, and how do we turn that into something, you know, use that entrepreneurial spirit and kind of keep pushing it forward. Yeah.
Tom, I wanted to ask you about this. I guess back in the day, how did receiving this award impact your career, and how did it impact the restaurant at the time when you received the award, and maybe in the subsequent year? You there, Tom?
Yeah, it was huge. You know, it was huge. I think that it, you know, put a stamp of approval on our foreheads. you know, and it was. I think, moreover, it was such a prestigious thing that I think we all hold on high to be counted among this incredible talent surrounding you within that context. You know, Food & Wine did their homework, and they continue to do their homework. And it must be increasingly more difficult to select because there is a sea of talent out there, and it's very, very cool.
Yeah, maybe you should do it monthly.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's the thing. It is very challenging to narrow down all that talent to 10 restaurants. And it's something that we take very, very seriously because, honestly, as I did the same thing as you did, which is look back at the years that we've been doing this, the 28 times we've done this, and the sheer immensity of the program, the sheer immensity of the talent that's represented, and the fact that you all are part of that history is incredible. And so we take it so seriously, and every month is a good idea. Good idea. I'll get right back
on
that.
Hate me when you're don't hate me when you're pulling those all-nighters every the 28th of every month. I want to make sure I get February in there. You know, the one other thing I'd love to just touch on, connecting a little bit of this, and then maybe we'll go to our break. But, you know, Jeremiah was just talking about the chef as entrepreneur. And, Tom, I mean, maybe you could just speak to this for a second. You know, even that notion, I think, when you were coming up was a relatively new thing. You know, you talk to people who were in Los Angeles, and there was very much, I think the real demarcation line was sort of when, you know, Wolfgang, I think, maybe went from being basically an employee at Ma Maison to being the owner with Barbara Lazaroff at Spago. A lot of New Yorkers point to Jonathan Waxman and Mel Master.
Or Michael McCarty.
But in New York is being, I know I've spoken to Tom Colicchio about this, is seeing, oh, you know, we can own restaurants. Or Charlie Palmer doing Oriole in the late 80s, leaving River Cafe to put together his own restaurant. But that must have been, I think, there was a lot of really empowering stuff going on right around those few years, no?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, for some of us, I think it was like a dog chasing a car in terms of owning your own restaurant. You know, the problem is that sometimes the dog actually caught the car. You know,
right.
It couldn't reach the pedals and no opposable digits. Consequently, you know, they go out in flames because it's a whole different discipline. I mean, you know, a lot of us grew up, you know, in the craft, you know, learning the craft on the job and learning how to cook and really not having a full comprehension of, you actually have to make money doing this in order to continue to pursue our craft. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's really interesting progression. Katie, did you want to get in?
Yeah, I do. I think that, you know, this, it is true that, you know, receiving the Best New Chef nomination, it makes you pause and take a moment and decide, you know, what are you going to do with your career? What does this mean? What are you going to do with this opportunity? And, you know, kind of all at the same time, I've got chef and owner of two restaurants, a cookbook coming out, as you mentioned earlier. This weekend I'm giving a talk at the Mother Earth News Fair about sustainability in the restaurant industry. And so I think that it's like, you know, Food & Wine magazine is giving you a platform, and it's deciding what are you going to do with that? And right now I'm kind of on this moment where I'm like, gosh, I need to find my voice and figure out what it is that I want that to be about and who I want to be in this career. And so it's an interesting place, I think, for chefs to be, and Food & Wine's a big part of that.
Great. Well, we are going to take a break in a moment. We are chatting with Nila Motamed, editor-in-chief of Food & Wine magazine, Katie Button from Curate Restaurant in Asheville, Jeremiah Stone and Fabian Von Husk of Contra and Wild Air in New York City. All of those guests will be staying with us. Tom, we're going to say goodbye to you. Thank you so much for joining us. It was great to have your perspective today.
Thank you. Great to hear all your voices. And again, guys, congratulations.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. And The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew will be right back.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market, America's healthiest grocery store with more than 400 locations throughout the United States. Download the Whole Foods Market app on your smartphone for recipes, sales, information, and digital coupons. Or visit WholeFoodsMarket.com to find a store closest to you. Have you listened to A Taste of the Past? It's a show devoted to connecting our current food world with its storied past. Host and culinary historian Linda Palacio welcomes chefs, scientists, authors, scholars, and revolutionaries into the studio to discuss food culture and history from around the globe.
Have you seen the culture of food change over the past 25, 30 years?
Incredible. It's been incredible.
Linda covers content ranging from the history of black chefs in the White House to behavioral psychology and the evolution of Italian food in America. You can listen to A Taste of the Past anytime on heritageradionetwork.org or on iTunes and Stitcher.
Welcome back to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. We're talking about the Food & Wine Best New Chefs, which announced its class of 2016 earlier this week. In the studio with us, we have Nila Motamed, editor-in-chief of the magazine, Jeremiah Stone and Fabian Von Husk of Contra and Wild Air restaurants here in New York City. And on the phone, we have Katie Button of Curate Restaurant in Asheville. I'd love to talk to the chefs here about this right now, and starting with you, Katie. But this is our last show of the season. It's our first season. And Jimmy and I were just talking about this earlier today as we were getting ready to come over here. You know, our very first episode was called Staying Alive. And we were talking with, at the time, it was Amanda Cohen, Gavin Kazin, and Harold Moore. And we were talking about sort of how hard it is for restaurants these days to stay kind of top of mind for their customers. It seems like, and this is something actually I talked to Jeremiah and Fabian about when we did an interview for my blog Tokeland last year. You know, it seems like it's a real sort of short attention span atmosphere out there, that there's a proliferation of restaurants that seems almost never ending. And it seems to me like, you know, an award like this has got to be beyond the honor of it and everything else. It has to provide some sort of precious lifeblood of attention. And so, Katie, I'd love to ask you. I mean, I've spent a little bit of time in Asheville. I mean, there's a vibrant restaurant community down there. I know the population of that city is expected to increase dramatically over the next decade. But what's it like down there when you hear people talking about these topics? Is it a similar dynamic there? Is this a challenge that you face? And how does something like this benefit your, you know, on just on a bottom line level, not to be, you know, crass or mercenary about it, but help you guys out?
Yeah, well, I mean, it is true that you do feel like, you know, as a chef, and you got to keep on the at the forefront of everybody's mind, and therefore you have to always have something that you are doing or you can say or announce. And, you know, I think, you know, a new restaurant, an expansion, a cookbook, events that you're traveling to and participating in, and, you know, the food and wine announcement, you just have to have all of these, the James Beard Awards, these little things that you're constantly saying, look at me, look at me, look at me, you know, come in. It gets to be a little bit exhausting, and it definitely brings up the question, you know, for chefs, because what we do is we want to be in our restaurants, and it's challenging to put people in those places and be able to travel and do these events and participate in things and still maintain your restaurant. So it's kind of a give and take in that area. In Asheville, you know, we're a smaller community. So while the locals for sure know their favorite places and they're really loyal and going back and frequenting the places that they just love and having the chance to rotate through all the restaurants, you know, we get 10 million tourists that come to Asheville every year, and it's getting their attention. It's captivating, like, that audience. Like, you have to, people in town have to be buzzing and talking about you, and therefore there has to be something new and interesting, and it can feel like a lot of pressure to be that new and interesting thing.
Was this a part of what you do that you anticipated when you decided to become a chef owner? You know, the analogy I always make, just having this conversation with so many people in the last year, is that, you know, when you hear people in Congress interviewed, and they say, you know, they spend, you know, 50% of their time legislating and the other 50% like on a phone somewhere off, you know, off site making fundraising phone calls, you know, so that they can keep being in their job. But was this part of the life, something that you anticipated coming into it, or was it something that you kind of slowly realized, like, oh, this is a real necessity?
I had no idea. It was, I mean, I was thinking, oh, I'm going to open a restaurant, I'm going to be the chef, and I'm going to be in my restaurant every day running service and keeping the quality and doing my thing. But it quickly became very apparent, first of all, being in a smaller community, I think sometimes we have to, like, shout a little louder, you know, for everybody to be able to hear us, because we're competing with Chicago or New York or San Francisco. And, you know, we've been very fortunate in Asheville because it's kind of in a booming moment right now. So we're getting a lot of attention, and we're trying to seize on that publicity, sure, the positive publicity for Asheville. So, but, you know, it's not something that I expected at all, but it's something that I quickly realized was really important. Because from each event, you network, you meet people, then another opportunity comes up, then something else, and in another city, and pretty soon the people who are in the food world in that city now know your name, and so it's it snowballs in a good way.
Great. Nilu?
Well, I was just taken by what Katie was saying. I think there's a couple of threads that seem so important. One of them is social media and the fact that you have to feed it. And so I don't think that, Instagram to me is where we all communicate. And the fact that chefs now have to make sure that they're present there, otherwise their absence is very felt. And another area which I'd be curious to hear about from the point of view of chefs is having PR. I was talking to one of our best new chefs at our opening night party, and I said, oh, well, how is it going? Are you getting lots of PR requests? He's like, well, I'm the one who handles the PR. I said, I don't know if that's going to be maintainable for you. And he said, really? You think I need a PR person? I said, yeah, I think you're going to need a PR person. And so I think it's so amazing to me the fact that these are really, really a kind of homemade entrepreneurs, and the fact that now suddenly there's going to have to be, as I imagine you guys have experienced, the idea of having a network around you that supports you and enables you to be in the kitchen but also be out of the kitchen.
Yeah, how is it? I mean, Fabian and Jeremiah, how has this kind of evolution worked for you? I remember we interviewed, I think, early in the fall, and I remember you saying to me, you know, Contra was such a hot restaurant, still is, but I remember you saying, like, at the end of, I think, your first year, maybe, or year and a half, that you guys had started to actually see a little bit of a reduction in reservations, and then you got a lot of the end of the year mentions, like you were on a lot of best of lists, and that kind of, like, you know, pumped it up again. It does seem like this is, even for you know, two really hot restaurants right next to each other, feeding each other, I imagine, in some ways, even for you guys, this is a thing.
Yeah, I mean, like Katie said, I think when you open, I mean, especially us, we opened when we were like really young. I was 23, you were 26, 27. Yeah. And, you know, we opened, no one really knew about us. So I think it's a very difficult landscape to navigate when no one knows you. And you quickly learn that you want all these awards. You know, you want to be best new chef because the ambition is there. But you kind of realize that in order to be influential and in order for your business to survive, to pay payroll, to, you know, keep your staff motivated, you need to get these things because then that will help you be a force in the industry. And I think that having PR, having someone who understands you and who can translate that to the media and to other people is very important. I mean, we work with two of our great friends, so that helps a lot.
Yeah, I think, I mean, honestly, like, we did our own everything. We did our own reservations. We didn't have
right.
a reservation system. We took it by book. You know, you learn from, I think, you know, it's funny because even though it's, like, even though it's 2000 and we opened in 2013, you know, we still started off like we were opening in 1984, you know? It was like we had a book for reservations.
Yeah.
We didn't work with anyone. I was a saucier working, like, breaking down meats and, you know, I was like, I don't have time to – like, we had big publications reaching out to us that we missed out on and that we messed up because we didn't check our email enough, you know? And I think that's like –
that's actually a much more common thing
yeah.
than people probably realize. I've heard so many young chefs say to me, you know, like do the kind of, you know, smack themselves on the forehead like they, you know, we blew it or we missed that.
Yeah, I mean, I think Thomas Keller could have emailed us and said, "Hey, I wanted to, you know, meet you guys," and we probably would have missed it because we just lost it in our inbox, you know.
Yeah.
But that also kept you in your kitchen more, and maybe, you know, helpful in being where you are today.
Maybe that's why we're here today, because, you know, we were focusing on the quality, we were focusing on, you know, the thing that we were best at the time, and that we still, you know, focus on is cooking, and I think. You know, like working with our friends doing PR, like a lot of that was just, you know, we need someone to be like, hey, it's important that you email people back and that you, you know, when they ask for something, you send them a photo of yourself. That's all they're asking for, you know, and we're like, oh, like, yeah, I totally forgot about that. I was going to do it yesterday, but then I had to, you know, and I was breaking down like, you know, three whole lambs. It's like, I just forgot about it, you know?
Yeah, there's definitely a class out there to be added to sort of the Culinary Institute. I don't mean specifically the CIA. I mean to cooking school curriculums about this piece of the business, because it's a very common thing. And also, just for anyone out there who's trying to reach chefs, text them. Don't email them. That's my advice. Don't email a chef.
I think, you know, the other thing is, like, I got to give credit to people. I mean, like, I remember, you know, running into talking to Carmelini, talking to Chang, and, you know, their advice for you is never, you know, I see these guys and, you know, I'm like, oh, yeah, you know, we're opening a restaurant hopefully next year. We're looking at space. Like, their advice for you isn't like, hey, you know, this is how you season the sauce. Like, they, I think everyone expects you to, that you're going to do your thing. You're going to know how to cook and if you're going to attempt something like that. And, you know, it's like anytime you talk to, you know, chefs who are in it, their advice is always about, you know, make sure, you know, you're doing this with your staff and, you know, doing this. These are the numbers and think about, the, you know, the important things about maintaining a business. It's like, you know, and all those guys have been incredible mentors. And even though you hear it, sometimes you, you know, I remember like they'll tell you the numbers. They'll tell you everything that you need to do. And then you open and you're like, I got to make this sauce. And you're like,
right. You know, it's so funny. Years ago, I did a, the second book maybe that I ever worked on. And it was an anthology. It was based on the CBS show, Chef on a Shoestring. And, you know, huge breadth of chefs involved. And I just started to, you know, be writing in the, around this field. And the thing that was so fascinating to me was the higher you went up in terms of stature and success, it was, were the people you thought would be the hardest to get to and get a meeting with and all that, they were actually the easiest. You know, it was really not a tough thing to get time with Mario Batali. It was not a tough thing to get time with Eric Rappaire. It was the sort of independent, one-off, you know, people who kind of hadn't figured out what you guys are figuring out or what you, Katie, are figuring out. Just people who hadn't figured out how to deal with that part of their lives. Were the ones that it was actually the hardest to get to. It wasn't, to your point, it wasn't, it, the people who had made it to the top had gotten there not just, I think, not just because of their chops. I think they'd gotten there because they understood professionalism and how to run a business.
Yeah, and you don't reach out to a chef during lunch and dinner to expect to speak with them.
Right,
you know?
Yeah. We're going to take just a quick second before we thank our guest, because, Jimmy, it's our last show of our first season.
Check it out. We made it through
we made
one,
it.
Of, the, one of the three seasons.
We should have planned a wrap party. But we wanted to thank, you know, the guests who have been on the show before. We've done 12 shows. It's been the support and the people who have come out have been amazing. You know, whether it was David Kinch calling in from Los Gatos or Sam Sifton calling in from The Times, our Kat Kinsman coming on to talk about her Chefs with Issues program in its, I think, 10th or 11th day of existence.
Hannah Raskin with us.
Hannah Raskin, legends like David Waltuck and Drew Neporant.
And then young guns like Alex and Alex Stupak and Gabe McMackin.
Yep. And some great thinker chefs like Amanda Cohen and Gavin Kazin. It's just been great for us. And that's just a very few of just too many people that we've been really humbled to have on. We have a couple of things in the works that we can't talk about for our second season, which begins April 28th, but some pretty
good
big
stuff.
Guests and some people
stuff.
We're really excited about who have some news and, some things launching that we believe we'll have in here, right around the time that those things happen. We'd like to thank our guest today, Katie Button. Katie, thank you for calling in. We really appreciated having you on.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thanks, Katie.
Jeremiah and Fabian from Contra and Wild Air, thank you, guys. Great to see you. Congratulations.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Nilu Matamet, Editor-in-Chief of Food and Wine.
Yay,
again,
Nilu.
Since you're calling it a new job, I'll say congratulations again. Great to have you here.
It's pretty exciting. Thank you so much.
And I'll be at the Chefs Collaborative Summit this Tuesday in New York City at NYU, emceeing their short talks, which is just part of a three-day program that begins this weekend. For more information or if you'd like to attend, visit chefscollaborative.org. Thanks, as always, to Storefront Music for our theme song, Heavy Metal Gumbo, and to our engineer, David Tatasciore. That's it, Jimmy.
That's it. That's
great doing it. Great doing the season with you.
It's a wrap, Andrew.
With that, I'm Andrew Friedman.
I'm Jimmy Bradley.
We'll see you back here in a few weeks on The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization.
To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.